This week on Crossing the Line, I'll speak to Saher Hamad, a noted spoken word poet, activist, and humanitarian. The author of three volumes of poetry, Hamad will speak about her recent trip to South Africa and the correlation between that country and Israel-Palestine. Then later in the podcast, a commentary by Mumia Abu-Jamal and The War Is Told, compiled and read by Scott Bergwin of the Stand Independent News Service. All of this straight ahead.
This Week in Palestine, a service of the International Middle East Media Center, www.imemc.org, for December the 22nd through December the 29th, 2006.
The residents of the walled-in city of Bethlehem, joined by tourists and Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas, celebrated Christmas this week. Festivities included a candlelight procession for peace and justice. A Palestinian man from the Gaza Strip died of wounds he sustained last month. The Israeli government approved the release of a small fraction of Palestinian tax revenues to the Palestinian government, and a series of meetings were held to revive Middle East peace talks. These stories and more coming up. Stay tuned.
Let's begin our weekly report with this week's peaceful actions against the annexation wall in the West Bank. Around 200 people, including international and Israeli activists, joined together in Belayin village near Ramallah city in the West Bank for the weekly demonstration against the illegal annexation of the village's land by Israeli wall construction. Nearly 60% of Belayin has been lost as the route of the wall cuts directly through the village. Soldiers awaited the procession at the gate west of the village and did not immediately intervene when several Palestinians and activists crossed through the razor wire and began walking the length along the first fence. Several sections of razor wire were pulled apart along the path of the wall to allow other Palestinians passage through to the barrier's fence. Soldiers responded intermittently with sound bombs and used batons to strike the hands of Israeli activists attempting to untie sections of wire fastened to the fence. The demonstrators remained nonviolent throughout. On the walk back, residents noticed soldiers had occupied three Palestinian homes at the top of a hill. Soldiers were using these locations to fire tear gas at youths not participating in the main demonstration. Demonstrators chanted at the soldiers, who retreated from one house but remained inside another and on the roof of the third. Soldiers fired tear gas, rubber-coated steel bullets, and sound bombs, while Palestinians entered the second home to force the four soldiers there to leave. In an ensuing scuffle, soldiers attempted to arrest one resident, Farhan Barnat, age 26, though residents and activists prevented them from removing him into custody. The military beat those attempting to free Barnat with clubs. Soldiers on the rooftop of an occupied home fired large quantities of gas toward the demonstrators and shot several residents with rubber-coated bullets, including Abdullah Abu Rahme, who talked to IMEMC.
The soldier who we stopped from arresting our friend pushed us, and after a while we were walking about 100 meters away from him, he fired at me while I was walking away from the scene carrying the Palestinian flag, not doing anything at the time. I got injured by two rubber bullets in my thigh. The guy being abducted was beaten up badly. Also, my colleague, Muhammad Al-Khatib, was beaten up by the soldiers.
On the other side of the illegal wall on Thursday afternoon, Israeli activists blocked the central downtown of the Israeli city of Tel Aviv with razor wire taken from the wall. The activists stretched the razor wire across Basel Street with a sign from the wall that reads in Arabic, Hebrew, and English, "Anyone who touches the fence endangers their life." The 20 activists from the Israeli Anarchists Against the Wall, who regularly attend the weekly Friday demonstrations against the illegal wall in Belayin, set up the blockade at around 2 o'clock in the afternoon and started handing out flyers to passerbys explaining the action. "The action was taken to protest the wall being built throughout the West Bank," said Yonatan Polak, an Israeli activist.
What happened today is that resituated a segment of the wall that was taken from the West Bank and put it in Tel Aviv. And the purpose of doing that was to remind the people of Tel Aviv what is being done in their name in the occupied territories daily. The constant travel restrictions, the land grab in the name of the wall. It was to remind people that all of this is being done in their name, hurting innocent civilians, and is under their responsibility.
The Israeli military authorities approved on Wednesday the construction of a new illegal settlement in the Jordan Valley, north of the West Bank, to house settlers who were removed from the Gaza Strip during the unilateral Israeli disengagement from the Gaza Strip in September of 2005. The construction of this settlement, originally intended to be a military base, began earlier this year but was only approved as a settlement to house civilians this week. The United States administration rejected this move and said that it violated the U.S.-backed Roadmap Peace Plan, which calls for the Israeli government to halt all construction and expansion of illegal settlements in the West Bank. Prior to the disengagement from Gaza, Israel had promised it would not move former Gaza settlers into the West Bank.
Local scouting groups paraded throughout Nativity Square in the occupied West Bank city of Bethlehem on the morning of Christmas Eve this year, playing drums and bagpipes to a crowd of a few thousand Palestinian and international tourists. The Latin Patriarch of the Holy Land, Michel Sabah, reached the southern Palestinian West Bank city of Bethlehem on Christmas Eve day and listened to the songs of the scouts and then religious and national tidings as Palestinian flags waved in abundance. Bethlehem's mayor, Dr. Victor Patarse, and the Bethlehem district governor, Salah Tamari, the minister of tourism and national security forces leader, in addition to the chief of police, Isa Hijo, were all in attendance. The patriarch presided over an all-night midnight mass in the Church of the Nativity, celebrating the birth of Jesus there over 2,000 years ago. The Palestinian president, Mahmoud Abbas, was among the attendees of the mass. In the beginning of December, the Palestinian Authority raised $50,000 to decorate the city of Bethlehem during Christmas in an attempt to attract more tourists to revive the fragile, declining economy of the city. But despite sun and warmer temperatures, the turnout of both Palestinian and international people for the Christmas Eve celebration was low, local sources said.
Like the last 4 years of Christmas celebrations since the latest Intifada, few local people and even fewer tourists, pilgrims, and international activists came to celebrate compared to Christmas Eve festivals in the past. Like past years, however, both Palestinian Christians and Muslims celebrated the day together. The shadows of the economic siege and financial hardships clouded the day. Isa, a Palestinian teacher and resident of Bethlehem, commented.
Because of this siege, there is no joy. We come here only because to allow our children to feel good. We are trapped in a big jail. You cannot feel Christmas as it should be.
At least 2,000 Palestinians, joined by many internationals, participated in a candlelight procession in the town of Beit Sahur on Christmas Day. The marchers lit candles, demanding an end to the ongoing internal violence in Palestine and the lifting of the blockade imposed on the Palestinian people. This procession, which was organized this year under the title Light a Candle for the End of Violence, Unity of the People and Lifting the Blockade, is an annual activity of the Palestinian Center for Rapprochement Between People and was the first of its kind organized by a civil society organization. Beginning in 1991, the march has carried different slogans but has always carried a message of peace to the world from the Palestinian people. The first march was titled Light a Candle for Peace and Justice and was a joint Palestinian-Israeli demonstration after the first Intifada of 1987. George Rishmawi, director of the Palestinian Center for Rapprochement Between People, talked to IMEMC.
This year, the march carried a message to the Palestinian leaders and to the world. We demanded the Palestinian leaders to end all the infighting and to resort to dialogue to solve internal conflicts. And to the international community, we asked them to take the responsibility to lift the blockade imposed on the Palestinian people, leading it to starvation.
In the beginning of this week, Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas, accompanied by a delegation that included senior negotiator Saab Erekat, Fatah legislator Mohammed Dahlan, and two of his aides, met with Israeli Prime Minister Ehud Olmert in Jerusalem. During the meeting, Olmert agreed to release $100 million U.S. to the Palestinian Authority, a fraction of the $600 million U.S. dollars of Palestinian tax revenues that Israel has withheld since last March, when Hamas was elected into the majority position in the Palestinian parliament. Olmert also approved the release of some 30 prisoners, of more than 10,000 Palestinian prisoners currently in Israeli jails. He also agreed to remove 27 roadblocks, which now total over 400 in and around the West Bank. The two sides decided to form follow-up committees that will meet soon. The Israeli cabinet in its weekly meeting approved the release of the small part of Palestinian tax revenues, part of which will be used to service debt to some Israeli companies and to help cover expenses at Palestinian hospitals in East Jerusalem. Hamas rejected the outcome of this meeting, saying that such meetings have been held repeatedly in the past with no real positive results. Fawzi Barhoum, a Hamas spokesperson, expressed dissatisfaction with the meeting.
The meeting was actually shameful. It has saddened every Palestinian, especially those who suffered to protect the Palestinian national sovereignty. To leave the fate of Palestinian prisoners for the Israeli goodwill gestures and to rush for meetings with Israeli Prime Minister and the Ministers of War for a handful of dollars or removing more than 10 checkpoints is ridiculous. These were the results of this summit meeting that took 10 months to prepare for.
Israeli Prime Minister Ehud Olmert received the Egyptian Foreign Minister Ahmed Abu El-Ghayt this week. They discussed details of a possible prisoner swap. It is expected that Olmert and Egyptian President Hosni Mubarak will meet together at the Red Sea resort of Sharm el-Sheikh soon. Furthermore, Israeli and Palestinian news sources also reported that Abbas and Fatah movement officials have been having secret backdoor meetings with the Israeli government to negotiate on major issues, including the Palestinian right of return, guaranteed by the Geneva Convention, and the removal of illegal settlements from Palestinian territory.
During this week, President Mahmoud Abbas and Prime Minister Ismail Haniyeh received an invitation from King Abdullah of Jordan to meet in Amman in an attempt to bridge the gap between the two leaders of the rival political movements Fatah and Hamas, and to resume talks over a national unity government. It is expected that this meeting will be held soon after the Muslim holiday of Eid al-Adha, during which Prime Minister Haniyeh will be on a tour of countries in the region, including Saudi Arabia and Kuwait. In a one-day visit to Egypt, President Abbas met with Egyptian President Hosni Mubarak to discuss Abbas's earlier meeting with Israeli Prime Minister Olmert and internal Palestinian issues. President Abbas said after this meeting that his door is open for talks on a national unity government. Mustafa Barghouti, head of the Palestinian National Initiative.
But most importantly, and this is my message to my people, to our people, time has come for us to be united. Enough is enough. What we need is to be unified so that we can achieve our goals. I think on this very special day here from Bethlehem, I want to say to all our people, press with every power you have for national unity government, for national unity of the Palestinian people, so that we can get rid of this occupation.
Media reports state that a shipment of weapons was transferred through Egypt to the Palestinian Authority security forces in the Gaza Strip this week. The Israeli government approved the transfer through the Kerem Shalom border crossing, north of the Gaza Strip. Palestinian officials denied these reports. There has been no confirmation from either Israeli or Egyptian officials regarding this issue. Fatah has denied that there is a deal of this kind. Israeli Foreign Minister Tzipi Livni announced that the Israeli government feels it is possible to hold peace talks with the Palestinians even during the continued exchange of fire. This week, the Hamas movement denied media reports of an initiative presented by Haniyeh's political advisor, Ahmad Youssef, to European and Arab officials, which included a five-year ceasefire agreement in exchange for an Israeli withdrawal from the West Bank.
Two Palestinian residents of the El Zaitoun neighborhood in central Gaza City were killed today when their house collapsed after an explosion. Sources identified the victims as Hassan al-Zimli, age 23, and Mohammed al-Masri, age 24. Three others were injured in this explosion. Hamdan Barhoum, age 24, from the al-Mawasi area in Khan Yunis, died of wounds he sustained earlier this month. Barhoum was seriously wounded by shrapnel from live ammunition when Israeli gunboats positioned near the Rafah seashore opened fire at a fishing boat on which Barhoum and two other fishermen were sailing. All three fishermen were wounded, with Barhoum in serious condition. The Israeli army closed the Rafah border crossing on Thursday, shortly after European monitors declared it would be open for 2 days. This move came after Palestinian Prime Minister Haniyeh crossed the border to the Egyptian side while still inside a vehicle instead of on foot, which Israeli authorities said was a violation of the border agreement. This week, the Israeli government approved limited retaliations against homemade shells fired by Palestinian resistance factions in the Gaza Strip on nearby Israeli targets. Two Israelis were injured, one seriously, by homemade shells fired on the Israeli town of Sderot earlier this week. Fawzi Barhoum, a Hamas spokesperson, said Israel never respected the ceasefire.
The resistance factions, including Hamas, reached a partial ceasefire with the Israeli occupation to stop all killings and invasions against our Palestinian people. Since the first day of the ceasefire, we recorded more than 150 Israeli violations, resulting in killing more than 15 residents, more than 30 abducted, and at least 15 demolished homes, in addition to ongoing invasions, as in the city of Tulkarem.
Palestinian resistance factions and the Israeli government declared a ceasefire in late November after a 5-month-long Israeli invasion into the Gaza Strip, in which at least 400 Palestinians, the majority of whom were civilians, were killed and thousands injured. The invasion occurred after resistance fighters from three Palestinian factions attacked an Israeli military base inside the Gaza Strip and captured an Israeli soldier.
The Israeli army invaded several West Bank communities this week and abducted 37 residents, including 6 children. 3 other children were injured after the Israeli army invaded the West Bank town of Kabatia, southeast of Jenin, and fired live ammunition at the residents of the town. Despite promises given by the Israeli Prime Minister to President Abbas that a number of roadblocks in the West Bank would be removed, the Israeli army continued to impose restrictions on the movement of Palestinians between these areas. 3 residents were abducted by Israeli soldiers at checkpoints and roadblocks this week. 2 volunteers from the International Solidarity Movement from South Africa and Spain were abducted by the Israeli army while they were accompanying Palestinian schoolchildren from a local school in the old city of Hebron to protect the children from attacks by the Israeli settlers. Israeli soldiers have been deployed in the old city of Hebron to protect the few hundred settlers occupying Palestinian homes there.
The Israeli human rights group B'Tselem released a report on Thursday that said Palestinian deaths from Israeli attacks in the West Bank and Gaza have tripled since the year 2005. Of these, over half were not participating in any hostile activity at all, says the report, which also condemns the Israeli army for using lethal force against non-combatants, among other human rights abuses. The number of Israeli civilians who died from Palestinian attacks this year dropped by half to only 17 people. 655 Palestinians died this year from Israeli attacks in Palestine. 1,169 Palestinians lost their homes to Israeli house demolitions. And, as of last month, 9,075 Palestinians, including 345 minors, remain in Israeli detention camps. Of these, 738 were being held without trial and without knowing the charges against them.
And that's just some of the news this week in Palestine. For constant updates, check out our website, www.imemc.org. Thanks for joining us. From Occupied Bethlehem, this is Jane Smith,
Jack Talhami,
and Ghassan Banura.
Mic check 1 2 1 2. Can you hear me? Mic check 1 2. Mike checked my bags at the airport in a random routine check. I understand, Mike. I do. You too were altered that day. And most days, most folks operate on fear, often hate. This is Mic check, your job. And I am always random. I understand. It was folks who looked, smelled, maybe prayed like me. Can you hear me, Mike? Red-cheeked with blonde buzz cut, cornflower eyes, and a cross round your neck, Mike, check. Folks who looked like you stank so bad the Indians smelled them before they landed. They murdered 1212 as they prayed, spread smallpox as alms. Mike, check, yes, I pack my own bags. Can you hear me? No, they have not been out of my possession. Thanks, Mike. You have a good day, 212. Check, Mike, check, Mike. Ayo, Mike, who's gonna check you?
It would be easy to spend the entire program talking about the accomplishments of my guest, from her Audre Lorde poetry, Morris Center, and Sister Fire awards, to her acclaimed volumes of poetry, Born Palestinian, Born Black, Drops of the Story, and her most recent, Zatar Diva. I could spend the time just looking back on her accomplishments in the theater with her play Blood Trinity, or her co-writing, performing, and Tony Award-winning turn in Russell Simmons' Deaf Poetry Jam's original cast. But I'm not going to bother with all of that, because what I would love to do is to hear this woman speak. Speak the words that you and I take for granted every day and transform them into a language of pain, anger, accountability, healing, and love. And that's what I get to do. That's what we all get to hear. The beautiful voice of Sahar Hamad. Sahar, thank you so much for joining me on Crossing the Line.
Oh, I'm so happy to be here. Thank you for that wonderful introduction.
You're very welcome. And I would love to ask, the last time that you and I spoke, you had emailed me back and said that you were going to head off to South Africa.
Yeah. And, oh my God. Yeah, I went to South Africa.
That's right. And I would love to hear about that trip. What were your impressions?
I went to South Africa with three other American poets, Lemon, Saul Williams, and Sekou Sundiata, all men. And the four of us did a show called Urban Voices, which is, you know, a South African produced poetry, like urban poetry event that I think this was its fifth or sixth year. And so we got to go to Johannesburg, Durban, and Cape Town and read our poetry and do workshops in all of the cities.
Wow.
So it was a really amazing experience because generally before the show, the day before the show, there was just an open call to the artists of those cities to come and meet with us and talk with us. And we got to meet so many amazing South African artists of different genres, mostly writers, because we were all writers, and that's what we were showcasing. And, you know, Johannesburg was my first stop, and it kind of feels a little bit like being in Ramallah, you know, downtown Johannesburg.
Yes, right.
It's where the middle class exists, if there is a middle class, black middle class, African black middle class.
Right.
South Africa. So you kind of like, you can go into bookshops and you can go sit in cafes. And I always told my friends that it was like Fort Greene, Brooklyn, but actually in Africa without the attitude. So that was like amazing. And it definitely, Chris, was an experience because I had left New York after, I guess at that point, the Israeli bombardment of Lebanon had been happening for about a month.
Mm.
And a lot of activity and inactivity was going around in the communities that I'm a part of in New York City. On one hand, people were trying to create art and trying to create resistance and popular movement towards the attacks on Lebanese civilians. And at the same time, the majority of us, I think, that I talked to really felt powerless because the for-profit media's image of what was happening in Lebanon and what was happening in Gaza and the West Bank just wasn't what we were reading on the blogs and what we were hearing from our friends on the ground. And so to leave New York City in the middle of all of this and to go to South Africa where for the first time, I mean, Palestinians are loved really everywhere they go outside of the continental United States.
Exactly.
But people were so open. And women especially would come up to me after shows and hold my hand and cry with me and say, you know, we pray every day for Palestinian mothers. We haven't forgotten what our people have been through. And I've never had that immediate and visceral a connection with anybody anywhere in the world, even in Palestine, where I often will be seen as like an American coming in just for the month or the 2 months that I'm allowed in.
I was wondering, you had said that you received that openness from the South African population. As you know, I grew up in South Africa when I was a boy, and all the while we were there, we had heard about the atrocities that were going on with the Palestinians,
Yeah. And
we felt a connection. Did you see that connection vis-a-vis not only just through
the people that you encountered? Did you see similarities between Palestine and South Africa, or were you told about them?
I mean, I definitely found a lot of segregation, cultural segregation, if not institutional segregation, that I think people would be shocked to find out that existed in South Africa. I mean, for instance, when I went to Soweto, there was no one for miles that was my complexion.
Wow.
You know, and I couldn't believe that. And then Cape Town, there were similar situations where we were in very kind of wealthy mall type settings, and there were no black people in restaurants.
Right.
So that was a shock. And I think through that shock, I was really able to look into the society, the contemporary South African society, and to ask questions that weren't based on this fallacy that everything is equal and free in South Africa now. And with that entry point, I have to tell you, Chris, and I say this with like the utmost respect and humility for all of the freedom fighters and people who gave up their lives to end apartheid in South Africa, but the stories that I was hearing, the pictures that I was seeing, the museums, and you know, what people were sharing, it's happening in Palestine right now, and it's happening on a level that is, to me, it seems somewhat, and I say this really humbly, much more violent and much more on the public, like on the world stage,
right,
than it even was during the time when I grew up. My political identity was very much formed by the idea of ending apartheid in South Africa and the cultural boycott of South Africa, which was so important. You know, that song, I Ain't Gonna Play Sun City, right?
Mm-hmm.
Like, that was the first political song I ever heard. And it was kind of rock and roll. So in my hip hop little vernacular, it didn't really figure other than, wow, like an artist, a singer, a musician, someone like Bruce Springsteen can say, I'm not going to play this place no matter how much money it's going to make me, no matter how much money they offer me. So there was such a connection. And I think for all of the Americans on the tour that I was a part of, we all kind of talked about this, the place that South Africa played in our political and American awareness of ourselves as citizens and as people of color, wherever it was that we kind of identified. Can I just tell you like one quick story?
Sure.
About Palestine and South Africa? So I went to the Apartheid Museum with my friend in Johannesburg. And on one hand, I have to say, I found it a bit sanitized. For instance, there wasn't like any information on the economic responsibility during apartheid, right?
Right.
There wasn't like exhibits on diamond companies or oil companies or any of the companies that had an actual investment in keeping apartheid going.
Mm.
So on one hand, I was a little disappointed in that sense, because I feel like for all of us, you know, I don't really know all of that stuff because I'm a poet. There's only so much of those things I can read.
Right.
But I like for it to be available to me and understanding the entire context of a people's suffering and a people's struggle. But we went through this entire museum, and the very last room of the museum is a selection of a broad selection of daily South African newspapers from the day before. And this is a really smart exhibit. Every day they put the newspaper from yesterday in these like glass cases, and article after article, editorial, petition, over and over again, the people in South Africa were talking about what was happening in the West Bank, in Gaza, and in Lebanon, and whether they were Jewish South Africans who were concerned about what was being done in their name, or they were black South Africans who were calling back to the days of guerrilla struggle. I mean, it was amazing to me, because I'd gone through this entire museum that's dedicated to what is called the end of apartheid. You get to this last room, and there it is, a newspaper in black and white and in full color. And also, of course, as you know, images that were not readily available, if at all,
right,
in the American for-profit media. So to me, that experience of being in that room, I just had shivers. And I felt like the rest of the world sees what we talk about when we talk about Palestine or Oaxaca. You know, the rest of the world is us.
Right, right.
And people see that, and people are writing about it. So I just wanted to share that experience with you, because it definitely moved me, and it moved me as a writer.
Wow.
To remember that, yes, every single thing that we put out there in the public will, you know, it can get to a museum in South Africa. It can get to a classroom in Gaza. It can get to a homeless shelter in Brooklyn, New York City. You don't know where your words are going to end up. And it gives you it's not a burden. It's a joyous responsibility to think that you can put out vibration in the world that will be illuminating and healing.
Sahara, that's a very interesting point that you're bringing out about the healing. Desmond Tutu has recently come under criticism within Israel, and he has stated that Israeli apartheid as bad, if not worse, than South Africa's. And I have made similar suggestions in the past when I've been interviewed, just because I grew up there. My father was an activist. My mother was an activist. My brother was killed in front of me when I was five. Do you feel that that is a fair comparison to say that the Israeli apartheid that is now going on within Palestine is bad, if not worse, than South Africa's?
Well, first, I want to say I'm really sorry about your brother.
Right. Well,
I mean, you had to witness that at 5 years old. So I'm sorry about that for you and your family.
Thank you.
And
thank you.
I think, you know, the idea of Chris, Desmond Tutu, and Jimmy Carter killing, you know, like talking about apartheid in Palestine, like the groups of people that are John, I think John Berger today. Is it Berger or Berger?
Berger.
He put out a call, I think a few days ago, but that's going around the world for a cultural boycott. And based on the blueprint of the anti-South African apartheid movement, I think it's absolutely fair to say that between the construction of the wall, the continuous land grab, the chemical weapons that are being used on Palestinian populations that are not being researched in the for-profit media, that what is happening, what the Israeli administration, and unfortunately, did you do that article with Ian Papp on Electronic Intifada? Was that you?
Yes, I did.
Yeah, so Ian Papp talked about the fact recently that unfortunately the majority of Israelis are consenting to this, to these tactics, if not by overt consent, then by silence. But it kind of, I don't know, I haven't been inside 48 in a few years, but I'm really scared to think that the majority of Israelis don't mind what is happening or are more and more leaning to ideas of relocation and expulsion of Palestinian people. So, I think you'd have to be proverbially blind not to see what's happening there. And there's water rights. You know, people, we have to remember there are water rights that are really important to the people there. We always talk about the land and we don't really think about the water sometimes. And, you know, all you have to do is go through a refugee camp that hasn't seen water in 2 or 3 weeks and understand how important water is to the rest of the world. So there are so many different aspects that occupation and dehumanization, like in your life, they affect you and they make you feel less than. That's what apartheid is, right? It's real, as they say.
This is my kind of love poem, because this is my kind of love. It is late, raining tonight. The only safe space I know is the air still warm right after a kiss. The place where lips almost meet. Breath lives electric. Need is past now, I hunger. Not in heat, but searching for more than a pyre to sun me. And my body is straining against sleep. Close, I want to be open and hide the children of Palestine within me. Head first, I would bear down, bring them into me. An act of desperate love. The Israeli army shoots children in the head. I would shelter them where it is warm, where limbs meet, where life is, where babies come from, horizon dawning. Pray these children grow up, fall in love, make love everywhere. Always be human, be alive. It is said sex is in the head, where God is, where to ancestry, where vision and memory and the ability to hear angels. Place Palestine's children in this sacred air between kisses. Breathe them in, love them safe until the Israeli army stops shooting children in the head.
That is the voice of Seher Hamad, poet, activist, and author of the book Zatar Diva. Now, Seher, your poem, one of my favorites, Beyond Words, is a testament to the power of language, both good and bad. And you write in this poem, just a brief section, and by the way, I cannot be able to do what you do, but I'm going to give it my best attempt. Desperate for your words, I can write, so I can keep from becoming something hard and unforgiving. Language has failed me. I am told to believe nothing I read, then everything I read. I am given my own face to be wary of. I am told to fear color alerts. I am told over and over, Iraq is not Palestine. Kabul is not New York. Now, Seher, right now, both here and in the United States and in Israel, language is being used to subdue, to indict, pacify, and to see people to further a system that is and has always been beyond words. The title of your poetry. What brought about the need for you to write this poem?
You know, I thank you, first of all, for that great reading.
Yes, I'll be here all week.
I think after I wrote Beyond Words, I went back and I looked at some of the other poems that really came out of, I don't really want to call them reaction poems, but you can call them reaction poems or political poems, but poems that come out of like a very specific moment in my life, and the kind of like any time in our lives we're always at these crossroads. Mm. And so that moment was not just what was happening in Rafah, and not just the images that were coming out of Abu Ghraib, and not just the hungry people and people dying of AIDS around me and around the world, but it was, I couldn't trust language, and I'm a writer.
Wow.
You know, and I was like, I don't believe that this is democracy. I don't believe this is democracy, what you're telling me is democracy. I don't believe this is fair. I don't believe that the system has ended because you put a period on the end of it. This is the thing about, again, going back to South Africa, was, you know, they had like a beginning and an end date, period, to apartheid, which means that you can, it's not a question mark, it's not a comma, it's not ellipses, you can't question this anymore. We have said it's done. And I just think that every generation has a responsibility to redefine their language. And because here's the other thing, right, that like, so these new poems that I've been writing recently, they're called the breaking poems. And a lot of times I will use simple Arabic words without a translation and without even a context, other than the fact that if I was to think in an Arabic-English mix, this is probably how I would think.
Hmm.
And so I was thinking about, like, when we don't use these words, whether they are words of a different language or words within our own speaking languages that we no longer kind of put value and currency in, then the entire worldview that those words carry are lost to us, right?
Right, right.
So it's not just the manipulation of the words that you and I are using right now to have this conversation, but there are also words that are being like erased from our consciousness, and with them all of the possibilities, all of the possibilities that those words kind of inherently carry within them. And I think, you know, you can pick up the New York Times and you can pick up Newsweek and you can see the same language used over and over again in administration press releases.
Hmm.
So I'm like, wait a minute. Aren't you, as journalists, supposed to be questioning the validity of this one statement?
Right.
Because this one statement means this thing, and yet here we have evidence of something else. And I mean, I just feel, rather than give up on human communication, I have to kind of dig for new language and new meanings for the words that we have. I don't know. Does that make sense?
It makes perfect sense. Thank you so much. So here, when we last spoke, way back when, we spoke about Black consciousness, and this was a philosophy that South African activist Steve Biko taught, that whether you are Black, Native American, East Indian, Arab, Latino, Latina, we are all under the same oppressive yoke. We're all Black, in essence. Was there a correlation between that and your first book of poems, Born Palestinian, Born Black, also trying to forge this connection with people?
Yeah, I mean, the title of Born Palestinian, Born Black comes really specifically from a June Jordan poem. And June Jordan died a few years ago.
Mm-hmm.
And she was a Jamaican-American, daughter of Jamaican-American immigrants from Brooklyn, New York City. Brooklyn seems to be, you know, it's just a special place. June Jordan wrote this poem called Moving Towards Home when she visited the Sabra and Shatila camps in Lebanon after the 82 massacre.
Mm.
And so for this African-American Caribbean poet from Brooklyn to travel to Beirut, to come home and write a poem, or she may have begun the poem beforehand. She uses a quote from the New York Times to begin the poem, but she ends the poem by saying, I was born a Black woman, and I am now become a Palestinian against the relentless laughter of evil.
Hmm.
There is, and then I think the next line is, where are my loved ones? There is less and less living room. It is time to make our way home. Now, I was 18 years old the first time I read that poem, 17 maybe, and was from Brooklyn and had lived this entire existence of being a minority within several other minority groups.
Wow.
In a working class immigrant neighborhood in Brooklyn. And I never knew that poetry could do that. I never knew that poetry can transcend whatever other people called you. She was like, this is what I was born, and this is what life has made me. And she made no distinction between herself and the rubble that people were, that bodies were under, and the bodies themselves, and the bullets themselves, and even the Israeli and Falange militia. Hmm. She made no distinction. She, this is all of us. This is me. This is the misery, this is the joy, and this is the survival. And so the title of my book came directly from her, and it is this concept of, you know, some people call it a southern consciousness, like a southern hemispheric consciousness.
Right.
Some people would call it a woman's consciousness, really, at the end of the day, because women all over the world, you know, especially women of color, I would think. So maybe it's a black woman's consciousness. I don't know. But I think whatever you call it, yeah, I'm definitely down. But that's, please, if you're, if the listeners can go pick up copies of June Jordan's work. She not only talked about Palestine and Lebanon, but visited Nicaragua and wrote a lot about her place as an American artist and as an American taxpayer in this world. And it was just amazing. And we need her voice at this time, and we need the voices of the young people that she taught in California. Actually, in Berkeley, right? Is Berkeley considered San Francisco? Well, there's a Poetry for the People program, which June Jordan founded, that still happens at the Berkeley campus. So people can go look them up as well.
This is for Jerusalem Sunday, and it is indeed for the city of El Quds, Jerusalem. Jeru, Salem, Sun, Day. Three muezzins call Idan. Where one's Allah begins, another's Akbar ends, inviting the last to witness Muhammad's prophecies. Church bells ring the sky, an ocean shade of blue above Christ's tomb, and the stones of this city witness man's weakness. Boys run by, the Torah strapped to their third eye, ready to rock their prayers. The roofs of this city, busy as the streets, the gods of this city, crowded and proud. Two blind and graying Arab men lead each other through the old city, surer of their step than sight. Tourists pick olives from the cracks in the faces of young and graying women selling mint, onions, and this year's oil slicking the ground. This city is wind. Breathe it, sharp. This history is blood. Swallow it, warm. This Sunday is holy. Be it God.
You're listening to the voice of Sahar Hamad, award-winning poet, playwright, and human rights activist. Now, Sahar, recently the fourth annual New York American Arab American Comedy Festival was recently concluded to critical acclaim, and it sold out houses. As most folks know, the media generally portrays the Arab community as the new boogeyman.
Yeah.
And often when actors of Arab descent try out for roles, they are often viewed as the typical one-dimensional Arab terrorist number one or the penny-pinching corner store owner number two. The Comedy Festival co-founder Dean Obadallah says, people don't know anything about us. That's why we're doing comedy. And indeed, this is true. Recently, a brief questionnaire was given to supposed Middle East experts about Arab culture. And overwhelmingly, the experts knew nothing about any form of Arab culture. And these are supposed Middle East analysts. Is this comedy festival and, like, say, your gift for spoken word poetry, are these helping to dispel these myths about Arabs just constantly being terrorists or people that we need to be fearful of?
I think to a certain extent they are. On the coasts, I think they are. On the coasts of the continental U.S., because for the most part, that's where these events and shows and conferences happen. Where I don't think, I don't know if they're affecting Wisconsin or Kansas. And as we know, the way Kansas votes matters. So, and I say that because I'm from New York City, you know what I mean? And we have, maybe in many ways in New York City, Arab American artists and performers may have an even harder time and to talk to people, to talk to the public without being politicized, or to have a political conversation without being demonized. I think in many ways it's more difficult in New York just because we have so much media, and the Arab American population in general, the immigrant groups who've come here, in, you know, from generation after generation, I wouldn't say that we have a powerful political lobby of Arab Americans in New York City. The dean, first of all, is one of the funniest people walking the planet. I think he's so hilarious. I don't know. See, I don't know if I write poetry because people don't know about Palestine. I think maybe I would have said that at 21 and meant it, and I can say it now and mean it, but I think it decontextualizes that in the rest of my life, you know, in the rest of my spiritual, emotional growth. And I think this is the thing, Chris, that we always have to keep in sight as we are the first, you know, I have been the first Palestinian in spaces. I still am a lot of the time.
Right.
A lot of my friends are the first or the second, you know what I mean?
Mm.
So you're always kind of aware of a politically charged atmosphere around you simply because of your ethnicity and sometimes your religion. I mean, we all have different experiences of that to different degrees, but that's only part of the larger picture. And I think this is the problem, is that we only look at each other within the context of the political conversation we want to have. So if, for instance, we're homophobic, we don't really allow queer theory into our conversation about race and class and economic structure. And really, I don't know how anyone can have a conversation about any of those things without queer theory in this day and age. You know, so it's like all of those things. So Dean, for instance, is half Palestinian, half Sicilian. But, you know, why he's really funny and why the festival does really well is not, is because he's talking about his entire life, you know. He talks about his mother and his father. He talks about not realizing that he himself was an Arab until after 9/11, you know. So it's like, that's what's really important. I think we have so few spaces and for-profit media to talk about what we do that we are always aware. I'm always aware of getting the politics out right away. You know, like putting it out there, putting out the position, because it might be my last time on television. It might be my last time on the radio. I want to be as clear as possible. But I think what we need to do is work towards creating institutions and agencies and just a presence where we can also talk about these other things. For instance, our contradictions, you know, for instance, our weaknesses. And rather than have to be like a flattened identity projection.
Well, listen, finally, Sahir, I was wondering if I could impose upon you to be willing to read one of your beautiful poems for our listeners here on the show.
Oh, well, I thank everybody for listening in this long, which was awesome. So I wanted to read one of the Breaking poems, but I wanted to read one that's fully in English. This is for the people of New Orleans. It's called Break Bayou. View our lives through the prism hurricane. Check what got flooded. Check what salt preserved. Check what wind kissed. You feeling me? See how we waited. See how we waited. Monarchs danced around us, muttered lies, murdered in fives and tens and twenties. We age gracefully. Our youth burns. We rhyme of rivers, swim in vernacular. Forest paths, irrigated soil, migrated bloodlines coiled around our aching spines. Stereo our lives through sonic boom. Check how we clunk. Check how we dip. Check how we slide. We loud and muted. You hear me? Powerless. We take death into our own hands. Gold plate our teeth. We crypt dance. Yes, we were sold dreams. Still, we bought them. Hear the receipt. We escaped, goaded. We marked and tatted. We never mattered. Feel me? We near washed away. Almost bombed out. Brass rings us. Exploded melody. The rushing of our flesh. We complex, son. Resented complexion. Life is court enough. God is witness. Hear me, feel me, kiss this.
And with that, we will have to end this wonderful conversation. I want to thank you, Sahir, for joining me on Crossing
thank
the Line.
Chris.
And I hope you'll come back soon and read more of your wonderful poetry. And please,
thank you so
dear
much.
Goodness gracious, don't allow me to read any more of it because it'll just ruin it.
Ladies and gents, soul music lovers everywhere.
All around the universe.
You know as well as I do that things are changing.
Warning.
Build your own vibe.
I got my fire.
Mumia Abu-Jamal is an award-winning journalist who chronicles the human condition. He has been a resident of Pennsylvania's death row for 23 years. Writing from his solitary confinement cell, his essays have reached a worldwide audience. His books, Live from Death Row, Death Blossoms, All Things Censored, Faith of Our Fathers, and the recently released We Want Freedom, have sold over 150,000 copies and have been translated into 7 languages. His 1982 murder trial and subsequent conviction have been the subject of great debate.
Other People's Congress. It actually may be too early to tell, but are you getting the vibe that Congress is going to betray you again? The Congress, both the House and the Senate, are seen as honest and trustworthy by an astonishing 14 and 16% respectively of most Americans, according to a recent poll. The converse of this is also true, that 86% to 84% of most Americans don't trust their Congress. A term like that just ended partially explains the gap, for Congress routinely sells its collective soul to the lobbyists and corporate powers that be. Only these wealthy forces could explain the actions and inactions of Congress in its most recent term. Complete servility to the military-industrial complex, the bankruptcy bill, their unbridled hostility to a minimum wage, you name it. If you could afford their services, cool. If you were a regular Joe or Joanna, working class, or heavens forfend poor, forget it. The Congress, in violation of the Constitution, ceded its power to the President, and the executive has made a complete mess of every power granted. The midterm elections, thought by many to have been a partial remedy of this disaster, was predicated upon the wide public will to get out of Iraq. The new Congress was not yet in their seats, and already there are whispers in the air of sending new troops, more troops, to Iraq. The march towards betrayal of the public will may have already begun. For millions of people, especially those who voted for Democrats, there is the expectation that this new class or new majority would headline on Iraq withdrawal. Now, it looks less so. As the new House majority forms, lobbyists are bellying up to the bar to make new and lucrative deals, and with money comes influence. Americans may learn that in politics, faces may change and parties may swap, but the same game goes on. From Death Row, this is Mumia Abu-Jamal. These commentaries are produced by Noel Hanrahan for Prison Radio.
The War's Toll for the 7 days through December 26, 2006. I'll be reading the names of U.S. and coalition soldiers who reported killed in Iraq and Afghanistan in the last week. I'll also be reading the names of some Iraqi civilians who reported killed. These civilians were reported killed on the 25th of March, 2003, just 6 days into the invasion. But first, the numbers. As of this morning, December 27th, 2006, 3,229 coalition soldiers have been killed to date in Iraq. Of that number, 2,980 are U.S. soldiers. The Department of Defense reports that 22,401 U.S. soldiers have been wounded in Iraq. They also report that 46,880 have suffered what are called non-mortal casualties. This information comes from iCasualties.org. Also, 377 private contractors have been reported killed in Iraq. These private contractors are from various nationalities. In the last week, then, 28 U.S. and coalition soldiers reported killed in Iraq. In Afghanistan, 515 coalition soldiers have been reported killed. Of that total, 357 are U.S. soldiers. The Department of Defense reports that 1,062 U.S. soldiers have been wounded, and also reports that 5,994 have suffered non-mortal wounds. In the past week, then, no U.S. and coalition soldiers were reported killed. Also, at least 17 Afghanis were killed in the past week, bringing the total in December of 2006 to at least 252 back to Iraq, according to IraqBodyCount.org. The number of Iraqi civilian deaths since the invasion, March 2003, is at 57,368. However, we know that in the past few weeks, the Johns Hopkins study released in the Lancet Medical Journal in the United Kingdom estimates that 655,000 Iraqis have been killed since the invasion. That would mean, of course, that hundreds of thousands of Iraqis have been wounded and could be over a million Iraqis wounded since the invasion, March 2003. In the past week, According to Iraq Body Count and iCasualties.org, 388, that's at least 388 Iraqis have been killed, bringing the total in December of 2006 to at least 1,482. The financial cost of the war, according to costofwar.com, is at $353.4 billion and counting. This is for just the Iraq War. If you are a taxpayer in Massachusetts, your tax bill is at $10 billion and counting. I will now read the names of some Iraqi civilians who reported killed. Again, these civilians were reported killed on the 25th of March, 2003. Nafel Abed al-Mohsen, 39-year-old man. Nahem Munaf Hassan, 53-year-old man. Muhammad Nafea Aser, 19-year-old man. Muhammad Ali Hassan, 61-year-old man. Marwan Tahir Nasser Amelki, 12-year-old boy. Mirwa Kreb Fakir Alanabi, 11-year-old girl. Mirwa Klel Salman, 17-year-old girl. Mirwa Dham Qasem, 9-year-old girl. Mirdan Gabar Abid Hamas Albo Zibner, 35-year-old man. Mohammed Katham Risan, 20-year-old man. I will now read the names of U.S. and coalition soldiers reported killed in the past 7 days in Iraq. On the 18th of December, Brian L. Minslaff, 34 years old, U.S. Army, Fort Worth, Texas. On the 19th of December, Joshua D. Picard, 20 years old, U.S. Marine, Merced, California. Also on the 19th of December, Andrew P. Dahl, 21 years old, U.S. Army, Brighton, Michigan. On the 20th of December, Robert J. Volker, 21 years old, U.S. Army, Big Spring, Texas. Also on the 20th of December, Jacob G. McMillan, 25 years old, U.S. Army, Lafayette, Louisiana. Also on the 20th of December, Scott D. Dykeman, 27 years old, U.S. Army, Helena, Montana. And also on the 20th of December, Miles Cody Sebastian, 21 years old, U.S. Marine, Opelousas, Louisiana. On the 21st of December, Kyle A. Nolan, 21 years old, U.S. Navy, Ennis, Texas. Also on the 21st of December, Ryan L. Mahan, 25 years old, U.S. Marine, Hawthorne, California. Also on the 21st of December, Ryan J. Burgess, 21 years old, U.S. Marine, Sanford, Michigan. And also on the 21st of December, Fernando S. Tamayo, 19 years old, U.S. Marine, Fontana, California. On the 22nd of December, Joshua D. Shepherd, 22 years old, U.S. Army, Quinton, Oklahoma. On the 23rd of December, Curtis L. Norris, 28 years old, U.S. Army, Dansville, Maryland. Also on the 23rd of December, Wilson A. Algram, 21 years old, U.S. Army, Howell, Michigan. Also on the 23rd of December, Chad J. Bulmer, 21 years old, U.S. Army, Grand Rapids, Michigan. And also on the 23rd of December, John Barta, 25 years old, U.S. Army, Corpus Christi, Texas. On the 24th of December, Evan A. Bixler, 21 years old, U.S. Army, Racine, Wisconsin. On the 25th of December, Jason C. Denfriend, 24 years old, U.S. Army, Cattaraugus, New York. And also on the 25th of December, Eric R. Wilkes, 25 years old, U.S. Army, Hamilton, New Jersey. This has been The War's Toll for the 7 days through December 26, 2006. I'm Scott Berguin from the Stand Independent News Service. As always, our hearts go out to the fallen, their loved ones, their relatives, their neighbors, in all countries.
You have been listening to Crossing the Line, which is produced by members of the Podcast Collective at the studios at 94.1 KPFA Radio in Berkeley, California. Special thanks to contributing writer Scott Berguin and Mumia Abu-Jamal for their invaluable contributions to this program. From all of us here, we wish you a peaceful and prosperous new year. In Berkeley, this is Christopher Brown for Crossing the Line, signing off.